Morning. Today's daf in Baba Basra is Kuf Nun Ches. We are on Kuf Nun Zayin Amud Beis. We are finishing up a topic from yesterday's discussion, and that is a very interesting topic regarding Shibudim, regarding this idea of placing lien on properties in order to be able to collect your loan. So, of course, we know. This is one of the staple topics of discussion throughout the Bavos, and that is the idea that if I have a documented loan, if I have a milveh bishtar, so that creates an encumbrance and creates a shibud, and that means that I'm allowed to collect my loan if the person himself defaults. So I just go to the property, and my lien attaches to the property to the extent in which, even if that property is sold to somebody else, I still now have a lien on that property, and I of course now have the ability to collect from that property wherever that property may be. And what happens to the poor buyer who bought that property? So Nebuch, it's unfortunate, but I take the property right away from him. So assuming that the land was sold to him with a guarantee, with some sort of achrayus, so then he'll go after the seller, and he'll say to the seller, look, you know, you sold me the property. Meanwhile, there was a lien on the property. Meanwhile, the lien holder took the property away. And so if the property was sold by achrayus, so then the buyer will go to the seller, and the buyer will say to the seller, okay, you have to reimburse me. Probably the seller is not going to be in a position to reimburse. I mean, consider the fact that the seller himself just defaulted on the loan and now sold the property. It's unlikely that he'll have money to reimburse, but anyway, and neither here nor there. Okay, so... So where do we stand right now in the Gemara, in the Gemara's discussion yesterday? The Gemara asked a question. The question started on Kuf Nun Zayin Amud Aleph. It was asked by the question starts right in the middle of the Amud. By Shmuel. Shmuel is the one who asked the question. And the question is basically like this. Look, I know that if I lend you money so that immediately, and it's a documented loan, that immediately creates a lien, a shibud on the properties that you currently hold. And now, going from this point going forward, if you sell that property, my lien is still going to be attached to that property. I am a lien holder on that property. What about the following? What if, let's say, after the loan is originated, so after I lent you the money, then you went ahead and bought property, can a lien attach itself to a future acquisition that you buy? And let's even say that you bought a property subsequent to the loan, and you sold the property subsequent to the loan. Can I now attach a lien to that property? Yes or no? Very simple question, very straightforward question. The Gemara continuously said yesterday, and we're going to hear this a couple of times today, and that is, according to Rav Meir, it's a no-brainer. Of course, according to Rav Meir, it would be fine. Why? Because Rav Meir subscribes to the position of the Machna Dovah Shloba La'olam, that a person can make an acquisition on a future. If you can make an acquisition on a future, you for sure can make a shibud on a future. The Rashbam yesterday pointed out, it's much easier to entertain this idea that you can make a shibud on a future, because consider a shibud is just simply attaching an obligation to a land. Land was there, just simply not owned by the borrower. Once the borrower assumes ownership of a land, he takes ownership of a land, so then the lien just simply attaches itself to it. According to Rav Meir, it's a no-brainer. Of course, a person can attach a lien to a land, even though that land is bought by the borrower after the loan was originated. However, according to the Chachamim, would it work? Would a lien attach itself to a future acquisition of the borrower? So the Gemara says, we don't know. We don't know if that would work, if that would not work. And the Gemara is in the middle of trying to ascertain whether it would work or not. The reason why we had this discussion, this is a Gemara's discussion, it wasn't the Mishnah, is because the Mishnah had a case which would seem to indicate one way or another on this topic. This is where we ended off yesterday. We quoted the Mishnah. The Mishnah talked about the case of the house falling down, both on the father and on the son. And we don't know who died first, which now leads to competing claims for the estate. The grandchild is, of course, the heir apparent, and he says, I should be getting the entire estate. And meanwhile, the son who died in the house, so he had, let's say, a wife, he had creditors, and they're saying, look, we're note holders, we are lien holders against the property. I'll get to that point in just a second. We're note hold. Let me just leave it at note holders. We're note holders against those assets, and we're going to argue that first the father died, then the son died, and therefore we should be entitled to get it all. That was the case in the Mishnah, and in terms of what the Mishnah concluded, it's a machlokes between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai says it's to be the estate is to be divided between the creditors and the heir apparent, and Beis Hillel says that nechasim bechazkasam, everything remains in its proper chazaka. That was the those were the two opinions of the Mishnah. In the meantime, however, as far as our discussion, it seems that this Mishnah is a perfect qualification of what we're discussing. Why? Because consider what happened in the case of the Mishnah. What happened was is that the son had note holders against him, and then subsequent to the loan, now the house comes in. Let's assume the father first died, then the son died. So that means that the son now has acquired, in this case, inherited properties after the loan was originated. And the Mishnah says that if that were to be the case, then of course the note holders would have now a lien attached to that property, and therefore have a claim to that property. That was the argument of the Gemara yesterday. That our Mishnah seems to be very clear that even if you acquire a property subsequent to the origination of the loan, a lien attaches itself to that property. That was seemingly the proof of the Mishnah. The Gemara simply deflected with a very simple deflection, and that is, could be that our mission is going like Reb Meir. Meaning, we know what the answer to this question is according to Reb Meir. The only question now is, what would be the halacha according to the Chachamim? So if we were to say that the mission is going like Reb Meir, so we no longer have a proof, and from that point we move forward. And we do move forward. We are now on the very top of Kufn and Zayin Amud Beis. Tashma, the Gemara says, come in here, and we're going to learn together a Mishnah. Mishnah is in Shvius, in the 10th parak of Shvius, and the Mishnah describes predated and postdated notes. Tashma, Shtarichov, HaMukdam, and Psulim. The Mishnah says that if I have a predated note, it is going to be disqualified. What is so bad about a predated note? It's very simple. What's bad about a predated note is that it allows the creditor to perhaps illicitly collect against an obligation that didn't exist at the time. So, for example, if let's say today's the let's see if I can do this right today. Today's the 29th day of June. Okay, yesterday I got it wrong. I'm right. So today's the 29th day of June. So let's say I were to predate the note, and so I lend money and I predate it, and I go back a month and I dated the 29th of May. So now at a later point in time, so let's say somebody buys a property from this guy, a property that was bought in the beginning of the month of June, and I, the note holder, say, hey, I got a lien on that property. I'm going to take it. I don't have a lien on that property, meaning even though I predated the note, that doesn't mean that the lien actually started a month earlier. The lien only, of course, starts at the origination of the loan. So then what I'm going to do now with my predated note is I'm going to illegally take a property away from somebody. I had no right to do so. I didn't have a lien against any properties that were sold or bought in the beginning of the month of June. So predated notes are no good. So they're possible. They're disqualified. So the Mishnah says, however, hamucharim ksherim. But let's say it's a post-dated note. Post-dated notes are fine. Now, post-dated notes could be one of two things. Either I could be lending the money now and just simply dating the document a month from now, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, or I could be lending the money now and just simply writing the document, let's say a month from now or 6 months from now. Either way, shtar muchar, that is a post-dated note. Now there, it's not a problem. It's not, now, when I say it's not a problem, it's not honest, meaning that's not when the note was originated, that's not when the loan, I should say, was originated, but it doesn't create any kind of problem, because what is it really going to do? It's going to weaken my position, me the lender, meaning that now my lien is not going to begin until a later point in time. But I'm not going to be illegally taking any land away from anybody. It just simply means then that basically the borrower is going to be, let's say I post-dated 6 months. That's crazy. But let's say I post-dated 6 months. It just now means that the borrower is going to have 6 months of being lien free on the obligation. But it's not. No one, no lekuchos, no purchaser is going to be. is going to be defrauded and have his property removed from him illegally. So shtar mu'char is not so bad.
But the thing is that you as a lender, you're losing your shibud.
Yeah, right. Correct.
So you come out of a disadvantage.
Right, you come at a disadvantage. But no one's going to be ripped off, so to say. But yes, you put yourself. Agreed. You put yourself in a disadvantage by doing so. Agreed. Now the isak adach diikne kane macher diikne kane vehorish lamishtabed meuchar mamayk sherem diiknehu. So the Gemara says, now let's consider. Let's consider that I lend them the money today, and I post date the note 6 months from now. Or let's even say I write the note 6 months from now. So the Gemara says, so how is this now working? So basically, aren't we basically saying that now we are creating a lien on a later time post the origination of the note? Meaning, the whole question was, can there be a lien established on properties acquired after the loan was originated? If we're talking about a post-date note, by definition, that means that we are creating a lien after the origination of the loan. Now, if we say that it works, so then that's great, it works. But if we say it doesn't work, so then the entire structure of a post-date note simply has no efficacy whatsoever. It simply won't work. So the Gemara says, "Hamani Reb Meir here, Damar Adamakna Davashol Balaolam." And again, the Gemara's deflection is very simple. The Gemara says, "Okay, but it's a Mishnah Shvius. We don't know who the author of the Mishnah is, and we could argue that the author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. And again, if the author of the Mishnah is Rabbi Meir, we know what his position is. He starts off with the position of Adamakna Davashol Balaolam. You can acquire." A future, and again, if you can acquire a future, you could for sure acquire a future lien on a future property.
The difference here is the lover already owns that property. He already has possession of the property.
Right, right.
In the other case, he doesn't have a property.
Okay, fine. I hear you and I agree with you, but still, it speaks to this idea that we can have a lien subsequent to the origination of the loan. That's the idea that the Gemara is trying to wrap its head around. And again, if you're a Rav Meir, it's a no-brainer. You absolutely can. But if you're the Chachamim, does it work? Does it not work? And again, the Gemara right now is at a point of inconclusive. Gemara continues. Amr Mishar Shemishmei Derava Tashma. The Gemara says, well, let's consider the following. Here comes another Mishnah. We saw this Mishnah already earlier, and we get to see it again. Shevach Karkos. We're now talking about the investment placed into the property. And Ketzad. What does that mean exactly? So So let's say I sell a land to a friend, Vihishbicha, and then he puts in money. Money to improve the land. And along comes a lien holder, and the lien holder says to the buyer, look, really sorry, but I have a lien attached to this property, and therefore I'm exercising my lien, and I'm taking the property away from you. And not only am I taking the property away from you, but I know you put good money into improving the land. I take that as well. I take that away as well. Now, how could he do that? Meaning, how could he take both the property and the improvements as well? So the answer must be because his obligation that was owed to him exceeds the actual property itself, and so therefore, in order to get satisfaction of his loan, so therefore he's going to be taking now the property and the improvements as well. Okay. Now let's go to the buyer. So the buyer now, who just lost the land that he bought and the improvements that he put into it, so now the buyer is going to go to the seller. Let's assume that the sale was with achrayus. It was with a guarantee. So now the buyer says to the seller, okay, I want compensation. I demand compensation for the land and for the improvements. What we are learning together now is the following. For the land, so for that he gets compensation from the seller, not only from any assets that the seller has on hand, any of his current holdings, but even if he had properties that he sold off, so they're going to be mortgaged against this sale, and that means now that the buyer can go after the seller's seller's previously owned properties and take from those properties as well. What about the shevach? What about the improvements? So to that, so the buyer can go only after current holdings. The buyer has no lien attached to the shevach that he put in. Now, why should that be? So the Gemara elsewhere tells us, the reason why is because when it comes to improvements, that's a variable. That's a variable cost. And the problem is that if we were to attach a lien to something which is a variable, so then no buyer of any property has any form of protection. If you don't know how much the outstanding obligation is of the person you're buying it from, so then the buyer literally is always going to be in a position of possible exposure to having the property taken away. So therefore, when you're dealing with a variable like improvement that a person puts into the property, so even though he has recourse against that, but only on current holdings, not on any sold property. Okay, so that is a Mishnah. Now, fine. That's the Mishnah. Isa gedacha deikne kana macha deikne kana varish lo mishtabed balchov amai gove shivcha. So the Gemara says, now, let's really think this through. Meaning, what just happened? The balchov, the note holder, who had a lien on the property, not only is going to be taking the property, but is also going to be taking the shevach as well. Shevach obviously is coming after the origination of the loan. It must therefore mean that there is a lien that not only attaches to the property, but even on the future shevach that's going to be placed into the property. Oh. The proof over here seems to be very clear. We are clearly allowing the note holder to exercise his lien on the property and on the improvements, and the improvements for sure came after the origination of the loan. So, it seems to be a very good proof. Again, the deflection is the same deflection. So it's a constant refrain of the Gemara. Ha'mani Reb Meir Yidamar Adamachna Davar Shalom Ba'al Olam. And again, the Gemara says, look, you quoted a Mishnah, it's an anonymous Mishnah, and again, as a to be argumentative, we could just simply say, the Mishnah is like Reb Meir, and we know what Reb Meir would say. We don't know what the Chachamim would say, and if that Mishnah is Reb Meir, which, again, it's plausible.
If it's an anonymous Mishnah, isn't this adopted as a
Well, we also have another rule: Stam Mishnah Karab Meir.
Right.
So okay. So.
But there's no.
Okay. I hear they said that's why the tension exists in this discussion. So anyway, so the Gemara says that Mishnah can be going like Reb Meir, and if it's going like Reb Meir, so once again, we have no proof to our question, and so basically right now, the Gemara is at the point of inconclusive. Now, in this point of inconclusiveness, the Gemara now entertains the following question. Imtim Salomar. The Rashbam says that this is now a new sentence. We're still on the same topic of discussion, but now we're basically resetting the discussion, and now we're going to introduce the following question. Imtim Salomar Dikne Kano Macher Dikne Kano Vahorish Lo Mishtabit Hala Mishtabit. So look, if you start off with the discussion by saying that there is no lien that attaches to a future acquisition, the Gemara says fine. So then we have nothing more to talk about. Then the discussion is over and we can all go home. Although I please encourage you to stay. But however, imtim salam and mishtabed, but if you are going to entertain this idea that a note holder will have a lien on current holdings and even on future acquisitions as well, so the Gemara says, I have a very good question. It's really good. Lava v'lava v'chaza v'kana. Let's say a person borrowed from one lender and he borrowed from a second lender as well. And so now, we know the general rule, and that is that as far as lien holders are concerned, so obviously the one with the earlier date is the one who's going to have first, he's going to be first in line. So in the event of default, so the first lien holder obviously can go and collect the property in front of the second lien holder. The Gemara says that we know. But now, assuming, right, and let me emphasize the word assuming. Assuming that a lien can attach to itself to a future acquisition. So let's say a person now has two lenders. Now again, one comes in front of the other, and then he gets a future acquisition. And assuming that a lien attaches itself to a future acquisition, Gemara says, now I have a wonderful question, right? Brilliant question. This new acquisition of this borrower definitely has a lien attached to it. Whose lien? The first note holder or the second note holder? Now again, on properties that he owned already, so we know the order is one, then two. But on a new acquisition, so the Gemara says, here you can really entertain the following question. Maybe the lien belongs to the first note holder, considering that anyway he was first in. On the other hand, you can also make the argument that on a new acquisition, so maybe that is closer in proximity to the second lender, and therefore his lien should attach to the new acquisition, not the first note holder. So the Gemara says, good question. So mahu lekama mishtabit or lebasra mishtabit? Is this lien now going to be attached to the first note holder or the second note holder? So I'm Rav Nachman, I'm Milsa Yibaylan. So Rav Nachman says, you know, we discussed this in the Beis Medrash. It's a good question. V'shach mitam, and we sent a letter from there, Rishon Kana. So Rav Nachman says, we think as a no-brainer, it should belong to the first note holder. Rav Huna amar yachloku. Rav Huna says, no, I think it is to be equitably divided. Because, again, it's a new acquisition. There are, at this point in time now, two note holders, two lien holders on the property. Now he bought it, so therefore it's going to be equitably distributed amongst the two note holders. V'cheintini Rabba Baravua Yachloku, and Rabba Baravua also agrees that it is to be divided. Am Ravina Madura Kama Rav Ashi Amalan Rishon Kana. So Ravina taught us that Rav Ashi had two editions of what we would call Gemara. Meaning, we know that Ravina and Rav Ashi were responsible for the final editing of the Gemara. And so, the Gemara describes it as a Madura Kama, the Madura Basra. The first edition and the second edition. Meaning, basically, it went through an editing. So, in the first edition, so, he said that on this question of, there are two note holders. Then, assuming that a lien attaches to a future acquisition, and the borrower then acquired. So who is a rightful, who has a lien now attached to this? So in the first editing of the Gemara, Rav Ashi said, first note holder. And then, Madur Basra, and then in the second edition of Shas, the Rav Ashi Amalan Yechloku, he then said, no, I think it's to be divided. Okay. As a very interesting historical aside, so the Gemara here describes Rav Ashi basically going through the Gemara twice, meaning there was a first editing and there was a second editing. If you take a look at the Rashbam over here, he writes, I'm reading it inside. Rashbam is towards the bottom of the Amud, Madura Basra. Keshechazel limud upam shnia nimsa b'tshuvos Rav Hai uperish Rabbeinu Chananel. So this is both brought to us, both in the name of Rav Hai, he was a Gaon, and Rabbeinu Chananel also. Rav Ashi Chai Yashishim Shana. So Rav Ashi lived for a total of 60 years. Uvechol shana machazu limoda b'shnei chachay kala nisim v'tishrei. They had what was called kala. Basically, it was like a convention, and it was biannual, and the and during these conventions, so they would learn a new masechta. So, so on the schedule, so they would be learning two masechtas a year, and in a 30-year cycle, you'd be going through all the masechtas. They're right, there are, I think the number is a little bit more than 60, but just to give it a ballpark, there are 60 masechtas in Shas. You're right, don't think, by the way, of just what we learn in the Daf Yomi, because that's less, because we don't learn all the Mishnayos in Zrayim and in Kachim. But there's a total of approximately 60 masechtos, and so at a schedule of two masechtos per year, so in a 30-year period, he learned it once, and then he did that again in the last 30 years. I know, by the way, I'm aware of the fact that there's a small problem with the math over here in that. right, correct. In other words, there's something called infancy. I understand. Huh? No. In other words, we're talking, when we say masechtos, we mean mishnayos. So, I'll tell you what.
Not the Gemara.
No. In other words, his learning is the Gemara, meaning Rav Ashi's learning now what is to what us looks like the Gemara. I'll tell you what's interesting to me is that Masechta Shabbos is 24 chapters. Sanhedrin, right, is, well, Sanhedrin's not that long. But the Yevamos is 15 chapters, meaning, and then there's like Masechta's like Chagiga, which is like three. So just out of curiosity, like in this biannual schedule, like you devoted as much time to Shabbos as you did to Chagiga, like, Maybe. Anyway, achronim v'hadur umadur kama hainu shloshim shanim rishonim umadur basa hain shloshim shanim achronim. And so when we talk about the first edition and second edition, we're talking about the first 30 years and the second 30 years. Okay, that's an interesting historical note in terms of Rav Ashi and his teaching over of Shas. No, it's interesting. The Gemara, right. In other words, right now, mine's a good point. Right now, your two options are basically either it's the first note holder, or Yachlok, or to be divided. But the Gemara does not entertain the idea that maybe the second one should get all of it and have the sole lien on that property.
But the future acquisition is a shibud against the first property. So until there's a default on the first property, they're not going after the second property. Therefore, the first property guy has a first lien.
Well,
the future is based on the first property.
Right. I hear you, but we can also entertain a following scenario in which, at the time when loan number one and loan number two were given, there was no property. And now, he then comes into property at a subsequent point in time, and so now, whose lien attaches? One or two? So your options are either it's going to be one, or it's going to be equal. Equal lien on the property. Gemara, one last point. Meisvei, the Gemara challenges this based on what we just learned together. Okay, so again, we go back to this case where you have a guy, he bought a property from a seller who was also indebted. And it's a case we just went through. And then he invested improvement into the property. And now the note holder had a lien attached to this property. He was collecting both the property and also the improvements as well. And when... And now the seller is going to be coming after the buyer, and the seller is going to be saying to, sorry, the buyer, thank you. The buyer is going to be coming after the seller, and the buyer is going to be saying to the seller, look, you need to reimburse me. In other words, your lien holder, your note holder took the property away from me, rightfully so, but now you need to reimburse me. You're going to be reimbursing me both on the property and on my improvements that I put in as well. Okay. From the perspective of the borrower slash seller, it's the same guy. So basically now, he's got two people coming after him. He's got the note holder, and he's got his buyer. And they're both coming after him. Now, the improvements that were put into the property by the buyer obviously came at a subsequent point in time. And so basically now, from the perspective of the seller slash borrower, so basically now, he's got two people coming after him. So, and we can now call them a first lien holder and a second lien holder. And so basically now what the Gemara is bothered by is, if you're right that the correct way to look at it is Yachloku, then on a future acquisition it's to be distributed amongst lien holder number one and lien holder number two. So if that's true, so then over here, the correct way to look at improvements is distributed between lien holder number one, lien holder number two. And this is exactly the Gemara's question. Gemara says, Im Isa chatzi shevach mi ba'ilei. So why are we saying that all the improvements go to one of the two? Truth of the matter is, half should go to one and half should go to two, if the correct way to look at it is Yachloku. So the Gemara says, my gov nami ditani chatzi shevach. So the Gemara says simply, yeah, you know what, that's exactly what the Braisa meant. That's exactly what the Mishnah meant. Yes, it's true, the Mishnah was not articulate on this point, but that's what the Mishnah meant, is that the improvements which came at a subsequent point in time is to be divided amongst the original lien holder and now the buyer, who is also, in this case, a lien holder as well. Okay. Adkan. Takes us to the end of that discussion. The halacha is that that there is a shibud that can come at a subsequent point in time to a property that was acquired after the origination of the loan. This point I'm not sure about, that you have to specify that in the contract itself. Meaning the contract has to state and articulate that there is going to be a lien on current properties and on future properties as well. Okay. We start now with the Mishnah. We're on Kufnun Ches Amud Aleph. This is today's daf. It's a new Mishnah. New Mishnah, however, same case structure. Over here, however, we're just going to have two different people involved in the collapsed house. Previously in the Mishnah, we had a father and a son, who the house fell in on. Here in our Mishnah, Nafal Habayis Alav Alishto. So we have a house now collapsing on husband and wife. Okay, so the Yorshe Habal Omrim, and so now basically assets are going to go to whom? Now again, we don't know order of death, and that obviously becomes a critical component of this whole discussion. Now, let's refresh everything that we know regarding what would be the case if we did know order of death. So let's say the wife dies before the husband. If the wife dies before the husband, so that means then, obviously, he's not paying her a ksuva, because he only pays a ksuva if he dies before she does, or if he divorces her. But if she dies first, there's no ksuva payment. And furthermore, he inherits all of her assets. So if she died first and then he died, so then that means that he gets everything. And considering the fact that he's dead, so that now means his Yorshim are going to be getting everything. Okay, let's go in the other direction. Let's say first he died, then she died. If he died, then she died, so then the ksuva payment now needs to be paid because he predeceased her, which the ksuva now triggers in, and he has to pay her the ksuva. Plus, on top of that, if there's any extra written into the ksuva, that goes to her as well. And so therefore, if she has a yoresh, let's say, right, there were no sons, and let's say she had a surviving brother, so if she has a yoresh, he now is going to be the inheritor of that ksuva and any addition to that as well. Okay, so obviously it makes an important distinction to know who died first, and obviously the problem that we're dealing with is we don't know who died first. And so therefore, what happens to all the assets? So Nafal Habayis Alav Al Ishto Yorshe Habal Omrei Misha Mesa Rishon Achar Kach Mes Habal. So the husband and his heir apparents, his next of kin, say that first the woman died, then the husband died. Again, they don't know this, but obviously... But obviously that serves to their advantage. And Yorshe Isha Omrim, and the next of kin of the wife says, no, Baal Meis Rishon, V'achar Kach Meis Isha. No, first the husband died, and then she died. So, in other words, these are two plausible claims that could be made. Again, like I said yesterday, this is what in halacha we would call a taina suffik. In other words, neither of them actually know this, but it exists in the world of plausibility. And so therefore, what do we do? Beis Shammai, Omrim Yachlokus, Beis Shammai, like yesterday we learned in the Mishnah, same consistent position of Beis Shammai in that. Yachloku, it's to be divided. Now, Beis Hillel, Omrim, so Beis Hillel says no. It's not to be divided, but rather nechasim becheskasam, ksuva becheskas yorshe abal, nechasim and nechnasim v'yotzi mema becheskas yorshe av. So Beis Hillel basically says, let's divide all these assets into three components, and let's talk about them in terms of their three components. Okay. So, so let's start off by first discussing nechsei tzon barzel. Okay, and again, just a quick refresher of things we've discussed time and again, but just as a quick refresher. So, a woman gets married. A woman gets married, and let's say her father injects money into the marriage to kickstart the marriage. She can take those assets that was given to her at the chasna, appraise them, and put them into the ksuva. So in other words, the ksuva, in addition to the base 200 zuz that he's going to pay her in the event of death or divorce, meaning he predeceases her. So in addition to that, also written into the ksuva document is going to be the appraised value of the assets that she puts in. This is what's called nechsei tzon barzel. Literally, iron sheep. Why is it called iron sheep? Or what's the idiomatic expression? It's iron sheep because doesn't matter whether those properties go up in value, go down in value. It does not matter. Whatever the appraised value is of those properties, in the event of the severance of this relationship, so he is going to be responsible to pay her whatever the appraised value was at the time of the marriage. It's written into the ksuva, and therefore he has to pay her that. Who is during the marriage considered the owner of these properties? Is it him or is it her? You could really see both sides of this issue. You can make a very good argument in either direction. On one hand, it's his because during the marriage, he can do whatever he wants with this property. Meaning, he's responsible in the event of the severance of the marriage to pay for those properties, but during the marriage, he can do whatever he wants. On the other hand, she knows that whatever he does to the property, in the event that the marriage is severed, so she's going to be getting a full restitution of this property to its full value as written in the Ksuva. So who is the owner of this property?
Doesn't this correct the argument of if somebody has the right to the period, is it considered owner?
But this is not. But yeah. But right. I was very clear. I mean, I was conscious about not using the word peiros and Karen because
he has the right to the peiros.
He has more than rights to the peiros. Right. He can. Right, in other words, during the marriage, he has full authorization to do what he wants with this property.
Can you sell it?
It's right. Meaning, he could sell it, but again, upon termination of the marriage, he and the estate are going to be responsible for its full value. Right. Okay. So.
Is its original value or the value at the time of the deceased?
No, as per its original value, as written into the ksuva. So. On this point, I could just simply say, let's table this part of the discussion because, and the Mishnah says, the Mishnah actually is not clear. Beisila omrim nechasim becheskasam. Nechasim over here means nechsetzon barzel. So you know who that is with? Cheskasan. Well, whoever its rightful owner is. I'm pointing out right now, and the Gemara is making this point. I'm not saying anything new. The Gemara is going to point out, we right now, it's hard for us to ascertain who the rightful owner is. But let's keep that as it is. Ksuva becheskas Yoshe Abal. Now, what about the ksuva? Meaning, the base 200 zuz that he owes you in the event that he predeceases her. So as far as that's concerned, so when the house comes in, so the heir, the next of kin of the husband, do not have to pay the ksuva. And that makes a lot of sense because it's a note. And when it comes to a note, meaning she's a note holder, but at the same point in time, we don't know if he died before she did. She may have died before he did. And we have the most basic rule of Hamotzi Mechaver Olav Araya. You need absolute proof before you collect on an obligation. So because we don't know what happened in the collapsed house, so the heirs of the heir of the husband for sure do not have to pay the ksuva. That one's an easy one. And echasam and echasam v'ayotzi mima becheskas yorshe ha'av.
You have chazaka. The other son has to prove.
Right. Correct. Now, what about the nichse malug? So as far as the nichse malug is concerned, the nichse malug now. Nichse Malug goes like this. And now it could be properties that she had even before they got married, but the likelihood is that we're talking about properties that she got after the marriage already started. Where those properties now go into the marriage, they're hers, meaning the principal and title of that property is hers, but being that they're in the construct of marriage, he can help himself to the peros, any fruit that come off those property. Okay. Who does the property belong to?
Her.
Period. He gets the payers of those properties, but the property belongs to her. So upon the collapse of the house, who is now the owner of that property? Who is the heir apparent of that property? Obviously her family, not his family. Okay. So, on three of the points, according to Beis Hillel, on two of the three of the points according to Beis Hillel, we actually have very good clarity. Meaning, nichse malug, it's hers. House collapses, we don't know who died first, goes to her family. Ksuva, his, because it's only a note. It's a collectible. We don't know who died first. Hamotzi mechaver olav araya. Nichse tzon barzel, toss up. Toss up by nichse tzon barzel. And the Gemara starts off the discussion on the top of Kufrin and Ches Amud Beis with. Yeah, who does it belong to? Good question. So becheskas me. So the Gemara's question is going on the nechasim mentioned in the Mishnah, meaning nechas nechse tzon barzel. So Rabbi Yochanan amar becheskas yoshe abal. Rabbi Elazar amar becheskas yoshe isha. Okay, so the Gemara brings a debate on this very issue, meaning it literally, it could see both sides of this issue in terms of who's considered the owner of the Nechsei Tzon Barzal. On one hand, it's hers, meaning it started off as coming from her family. On the other hand, he goes over to the husband at the marriage. On the other hand, the husband is going to be responsible upon the termination of the marriage to make full restitution of it to her. So
the fact that she chooses at the beginning Tzon Barzal, that means that they really want to keep it. Keep it the same as the family, the father. So that means that, otherwise, why would they choose Tzon Barzal?
I understand that, but at the very same time,
they want to retain it.
I understand that, but I hear you. Again, I'm just going to argue the other side because the Gemara clearly sees both sides of it. On the other hand, it is assigned over to him at the marriage. Yes, it's true, he's going to have to make full restitution upon termination of the marriage. But they're assigning it over to him.
So there's no benefit in terms of doing Tzon Barzal then?
In other words, the benefit is going to be, you know, in case of. But you're right. In its current state, you're right.
If it's in the case of death.
Yeah. So, Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Cheskes, Yoshe Isha, Rabbi Shimon, Malakish, Mishim, Bar Kapara, Amar Yechloku. And there's a third option, and that's Reish Lakish, who says, in the name of Bar Kapara, that it is to be divided. V'chintini Bar Kapara, ho, v'alala l'bayin lirash, v'alala l'bayin lirash, Yechloku. Meaning, actually, not only do I see both sides of it, but I so see both sides of it, that for sure, Yechloku, that for sure, the correct resolution is going to be a division of the Nechsei Tzon Barzal. So where do we stand right now in the Gemara? Just in terms of a quick recap of this last mission and the last discussion of the Gemara. Question. If the house collapses on the husband and on the wife, so what happens to the assets? Who gets to inherit it? So basically, here's what we know and here's what we're not sure of. What we know is Iksuva, his family gets to keep the Iksuva. They don't have to pay to her family. As far as Nichse Malug, her family takes the Nichse Malug. It was hers to begin with. She was the title owner of it. It's hers. In terms of the Nichse Tzon Barzal, Gemara says, I can make an argument it's his, I can make an argument that it's hers, and I can also make an argument that it is to be divided. The halacha is it is to be divided. Mishnah. Nafal habayis alav al imo. The house falls in on both he and his mother. So we had he and the father, we had he and the wife, and now we have he and his mother. Okay. Eila ve'eila modim shiach loku. So over here, it is agreed upon that it is to be divided. Okay, let's... Perfect. So over here, it's fair to ask, and not just fair to ask, but in other words, in the Mishnah, we just learned together in the Amud Aleph, where it was he and the wife, so we were having a debate between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And Beit Shammai's position was, well, let's divide everything. And Beit Hillel says, no, let's keep everything in its proper chazakah. Here now, it's kind of the same case, meaning it just happens to be two different people involved, but he and his mother now are in the house collapses, and Eilav Eilav Modim, and we all now agree that the money's to be divided. What happened over here in this Mishnah, where in the previous Mishnah, Beit Hillel goes by Chazakah, and Beit Shammai goes by division, what happened? So the Rashbam explains over here as follows. Let's do the Rashbam now, and then I'll continue tomorrow. So Eilav Eilav Modim Shiachloku Dishneim Bayim Mikovach Tainas Yerushas Nechseim Shehuchzuku Bahem Ha'isha Levada Bechaya Ba'amunusa Belo Baal Velo Dami Lenafal Abayis Alava Al Aviv Dela El. And it's not similar to the case where the house fell on him and his father. Dehasam Zeba Mikovach Yerusha VeZeba B'Tainas Shtarchov. Because previously, in the case of the house falling down on he and his father, what were the competing claims? The competing claims was that the son/grandson, the surviving son/grandson, was coming through Yerusha. Who was competing against him? Note holders. So basically, it was a competing claim of a note holder against someone who stands to inherit. What's more organic? The one who stands to inherit is obviously going to be more organic, more natural than a note holder.
Really natural,
meaning it's going to happen automatically. the note holder is only a manufactured obligation. Okay, so there in that case, you have two different types of claims. And also in the previous Mishnah, when we had the house falling in on the husband and the wife, so once again, we're not talking about equal assets. We're talking about assets that are more shaykh to him, assets that are more shaykh to her. So again, so that Mishnah is going to come out with a different conclusion. Avahacha, over here, however, when the son and the mother are in the house together and the house collapses, so the son and the son's next of kin are coming mikoach Yerusha. The mother and her next of kin are coming mikoach Yerusha. So now it's Yerusha against Yerusha. Yerusha against Yerusha. That is equal competing claims one against the other. Therefore, explains the Rashbam, that's why Elu ve'elu modim, both Beisham and Beisola are going to agree, Yachloku, that the assets are now to be divided amongst the competing claims, considering that in this case, they are of equal stature. Okay, I'll finish reading the Mishnah, and tomorrow we'll pick it up right with the Gemara. So, Eilav Eilav Modim Sheachlok Amar Rabbi Kiva Moda Ani Bezusheach Nechasim Becheskasam. Now, Rabbi Kiva's of the opinion that Moda Ani, I agree. The word agree over here is a strange word in this context. He's not agreeing; he's disagreeing. The Rashbam writes over here. He's just using the word Moda as a foil because the Gemara's previous the Mishnah's previous sentence was Modim. So it's stylistic. But over here, it just simply means I disagree. And I say, in a chasim beches kasam, it should go to its rightful muchzak. Who is that going to be? Stay tuned. That we're going to start off tomorrow's discussion with. And Ben Azai has an editorial comment reserved for Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, what are you doing? We have so many debates between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. We have a moment here where there's agreement between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. At least we have one version that they agree on this particular issue. Rabbi Akiva, you want to now create debate where we have agreement? All right, and that's the line of the Mishnah. Al chalukim anu mitzarim. We're pained over the amount of debate that already exists between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. And now, you want to create more debate on this topic? At least let's go with the version that we have as presented at the beginning of the Mishnah, that they agree on this particular case scenario.
I mean, he was like two or three generations left of Beit Shammai. How could he even have a stand on anything?
Right. In other words, he must have had a different Masorah in terms of...
So he was Pinchas Ben Yair, right?
I mean, meaning the Tanakhama, keep in mind also, by the way, when the Tanakhama is recording Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel's position, that is also, you know, in historical retrospect. Meaning, the Tanakhama's version of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is not, they didn't hear it firsthand.
Right.
Okay, so Rabbi Kiva must have had a different version on it. Okay, we'll pause over here. Tomorrow we pick it up with the Gemara, and good.